Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a contributor to the Bulwark. And I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor of strategy emeritus at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, how are you on this fine, beautiful day?
I'm doing pretty well. You know, it's the Jewish holiday of Shavuot, in which the tradition is to just to eat lots of cheesecake, and you really can't get enough of it. I mean, that's my conclusion. But we should probably move to the issues of the week. As always, we need to begin with the jackassery of the week. But Ted, why don't you start, and then I'll follow on. I've got my candidate.
You know, I just completely have given up on trying to keep track of all the jackassery, by the way, because it's just so many. But to me, the thing that's been most disturbing has been the kind of president's constant tweeting and tweeting out things that contradict what other senior officials are doing. We'll get into discussion of Iran, but the back and forth between his tweets and the news stories about what exactly is on offer to the Iranians is hardly a case study in how you should conduct diplomacy. But the tweet that disturbed me the most was a tweet the other day where he said, "I've been talking to our senior military leaders. We are stockpiling weapons like nobody's business." And anybody who follows this, even, you know, reasonably in detail, knows that we have been running down our stockpile of precision munitions, of missile defense interceptors, that our defense industrial base has shown itself incapable of replenishing those stocks in anything like a timely manner. And you wonder what, you know, whether he misheard what the chiefs were telling him, or whether he's just creating his own reality, as he tends to do. But I think it's dangerous to be operating at that level of unreality about the material circumstances of our defense establishment.
Yeah, I you know, my amateur psychologist, the amateur psychologist in me says that he, I think he finds any suggestion that anything that he's doing is not completely successful threatening in some way. So he has to deny it. And as you say, create his own reality. And what I suspect actually happened is somebody said, you know, we were running low on whatever, you know, the critical munitions are. And so he has to go rush out, deny it. And of course he'll have a bunch of sycophants reaffirm that. My candidate for the jackassery of the week was, in a way, it's more sad than kind of darkly amusing. And that was this exchange between Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa and a bunch of her constituents in a town hall where, you know, in a state where I guess about a fifth of the people are on Medicaid. She was quite flippant about the prospective cuts in Medicaid. And, you know, she says, well, we're all going to die anyway. And then there was a furore after that. And the normal political thing would be to say, oh, I'm terribly sorry. That was a flip comment. I should not have said that. The serious issues here are A, B, and C. And Joni Ernst is a serious, or I always thought was a serious person. And instead what she did is she doubled down. And there's, you know, another statement where, you know, she's kind of mocking people who believe in the tooth fairy. And, you know, the thing that occurred to me is, you know, somebody who reluctantly, I think, decided to throw in her lot with Trump, and she agonized a bit about it, I think, particularly over the Hegseth nomination. You know, once you get into that mud pit, the mud sticks to you, and you begin behaving the way they do. And, you know, with the same kind of callousness, and superficiality and kind of smart aleck wisecracks, which, you know, you might see on a playground, but have no place in the Senate. And it's, I think it unfortunately just shows what the effect of associating with Trump are. And this, I'm sure this will not be the last case either for her or for others.
It's very hard to disagree with any of that. I mean, this was someone who, when I used to testify in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee, which I think I've done on 10 or 11 occasions in the last 10 or 15 years or so, someone who I usually actually enjoyed testifying in front of because she asked very thoughtful, very good questions. And my reaction to this is pretty much the same as yours. There's a larger issue of the mendacity going on about the budget, which interestingly, even Elon Musk seems to have been too much for him. But the notion that, you know, what they've done is only cut, you know, illegal immigrants, you know, out of Medicaid is just belied by, you know, the CBO scoring of the bill. And you know, it's so now the CBO, which the Republicans, when, you know, they were not in control of the Congress, seemed to rely on all the time to attack various, you know, Biden administration, you know, proposals or Obama administration proposal before it. Now, of course, it's part of the deep state and it's unreliable and it can't be trusted. And this is just part of the larger, you know, attack on empiricism that is really worrisome in the sense that you see it play out in the Department of Health and Human Services, where essentially people are being told you can't publish in, you know, peer-reviewed journals, but we're going to publish a study that we're going to use AI to write that, you know, is going to cite non-existent journal articles. But don't write in a peer-reviewed journal because we think those are all, you know, fake news. Look, a country can't survive operating on myths in a complete environment of unreality. And that's what I'm, you know, afraid we're entering here.
I think you put your finger on it. There's a wonderful George Orwell essay, In Front of Your Nose, where at the end of World War II, he's kind of keeping track of all the things he said during the war, and to his credit saying, boy, I was really wrong. And he talks about how in politics, people have this tremendous capacity for wishful thinking, more than they do, absolutely more than they do in their own lives, where 2 + 2 has to equal 4. And he said, you know, this can go on indefinitely until it bumps into reality. And then he says, usually on a battlefield. And I think I find myself increasingly concerned that could happen to us. Particularly, I think, with the Chinese. You know, this is a bit of a digression from where we were going to go, but, you know, you and I have both been chuckling a bit about the taco trade. Taco for Trump always chickens out. And you've been scattering taco emojis all over your text messages to me.
I have.
But the truth is, you know, I think that there's an argument to be made that the Chinese have sort of have absolutely taken the measure of this guy. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, Jamie Dimon came back from China and says, they're not afraid of us. And, you know, but that has military applications too. Now, I don't think the Chinese are particularly adventurous in a military way. But you know, this kind of hallucination and wishful thinking and braggadocio and so on, it can really get you into a world of hurt. Either where you get into a war which goes very badly, or you surrender all kinds of values without fighting because you somehow convince yourself that it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes, you know, look at the news and I think, you know, some days I wake up and think I've awakened and I'm in an episode of Veep, and some days I wake up and think I'm in, you know, a South Asian magical realism novel, you know, because the the force field of magical thinking that the president radiates, and which, you know, people fall into, as you were saying earlier, is, you know, it's a powerful political thing. I can see that, you know, and it's got a lot of adherents. I'm still astounded that, you know, after everything that's happened, the sort of, you know, destruction of U.S. soft power in the last 4 months, the assaults on, you know, some of our competitive strategic advantages, like our university system, like immigration that brings brain drain to the United States, and we've now created a kind of reverse brain drain. You know, all of this stuff is, you know, is so dystopian. It's hard to, you know, kind of shake oneself out of the idea that, you know, A, this can't go on, and B, that it you know, it's got to end at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I think it ends, but it may not end for a while. And I think I've said privately, I don't know if I've said it on the podcast, you know, I think I always thought that the first year and a half of the Trump administration this time around would be the worst. I mean, last time around, it was the last year that was the worst, I think. This time around, it's going to be the first year and a half, particularly assuming that they get badly beaten in the midterms, but we'll see. But meanwhile, there's another kind of movie that's out there, a James Bond movie in which a bunch of daring Ukrainians send a bunch of trucks all over Russia. These things automatically pop open, and 167 drones, possibly guided by artificial intelligence, fly out and destroy, what, 15, 20, as much as 30% of Russia's long-range strategic bomber force. What do you think of that?
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Support American-made tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
My fact this week is that Andy Warhol would regularly have his wig cut by a barber and then return the following month wearing a new, longer wig.
Hello, we are No Such Thing as a Fish. We are a British podcast all about facts and trivia and everything interesting in the whole wide world.
We cover everything from pufferfish rectums to the moon to mangrove forest. What else do we do, James?
Oh, well, what about the fact that in 1936, a robot in California shot its inventor in the head?
There you go. If you're intrigued to hear more, peppered with some bad puns and some crude jokes, then check us out. We are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Well, I mean, not only that, you have actually some of the major supports today of the Kerch Bridge being blown up by a submersible, apparently a submersible of some kind, although it's not exactly clear how that operation happened. Look, this is all good news for, you know, for the Ukrainians. Obviously, it's a morale boost. It also has some, I mean, I wouldn't over estimate this, but it has some impact on, you know, Russia's ability to use those long range aircraft to drop glide bombs on Ukraine. That's been a big part of, you know, Russian warfare in the last year or two. It actually, some of my colleagues have been getting, you know, some humorous text messages saying this will make it a lot easier for the Russians to abide by the new START treaty. You know, some of their strategic bombers were disabled in this. So that's all, you know, to the good. I do think, though, that, you know, I've seen, you know, some people kind of getting way out ahead of themselves, I think, leaning forward in their skis, saying this is the future of warfare. All warfare is going to be, you know, like this. And, you know, I don't think that is right either. I mean, it's been clear for some time that autonomy and AI were going to be important parts of the future of warfare. is it all going to look like this? I don't think so. I mean, I think it's going to look different in different, you know, theaters. But a very important, you know, event nonetheless. Now, how much does it, you know, it's imposed costs on the Russians. How much does that affect Putin's calculus? We'll have to see. You know, there are other signs that the Russians have been winding up for a kind of summer offensive, and they have been making slow but still greater progress, you know, on the front line in, you know, Donetsk and in the Kherson area. So, you know, we'll have to see whether this actually changes the calculus or not.
So I take a view which is a little bit more that this is really quite significant for a bunch of reasons.
I'm not saying it's not significant. I'm just saying.
I understand, but I think it's more of a signpost maybe than you seem to suggest, for the following reasons. You know, on the one hand, this sort of thing is something that, you know, it happened in the world wars. I mean, in some ways, this is just a big sabotage operation. The idea of having weapons concealed in sort of commercial things, you know, the Germans did this during both world wars, where they had things that looked like merchant ships. And then, you know, you flip over some panels and there's a big gun, and they go out and they sink a bunch of merchant ships. Both world wars, for the first year or two of both wars, that was a bigger headache for the Royal Navy than German submarines. But having said that, I think it's there are three ways in which this strikes me as being a bigger deal. The first is just the issue of range. That from now on in any war, you cannot assume that the homeland is protected in some way. If we have been so used to that in the world wars and Korea and Vietnam, and that you just can't, nobody can assume that, I think. I mean, you know, Russia's an authoritarian state with a pretty good secret police, and you had that happen. And I think, you know, what that means is that your opposition, no matter who that is, and no matter what kind of country you are, can find ways of imposing tremendous costs. I mean, one of the points a number of people have made is, and there's actually, I think, footage of this about this on social media. Okay, so now they're stopping every truck and inspecting it and, you know, checking the credentials of every truck driver. And, you
big,
know,
you big can, traffic jams in Siberia. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, traffic jams in Siberia, who knew? And so I think you can, the opportunities for really big cost imposition are important. Second thing is, and a lot of this will depend on, you know, what it turns out that was guiding these drones, but it does appear that it may well be artificial intelligence. And that's a very big deal. I mean, that if you've got things which can go out and look for targets and guide themselves to it's, and that is accessible to everybody. And the Ukrainians have a good technical base, but basically, you know, sooner or later, everybody can do this. At some point, we should have a larger discussion about AI, because I think I'm now becoming one of the AI dystopians after reading an article about a AI program that refused to turn itself off when it was instructed to. You know, it wanted to live.
Sorry, Dave, I can't do that.
Exactly. But you know, I mean,
the reference dates both of us.
It does. For those of you who were born a little bit more recently than the end of the last century, it's a reference to 2001 Space Odyssey, where the computer takes charge, which actually, you know, pretty striking. The thing, you know, but with AI now, I mean, the Israelis have been using it for target recognition and targeting and stuff like that. This is use of it for autonomous systems. AI is taking off by leaps and bounds. This is not a technology. This technology may be developed in the United States or in China, but it's just going to diffuse all over the place. And so autonomous systems, there are all kinds of issues. And the third thing is, it strikes me that this is the sort of thing that will give people ideas. mean, how hard do you really think it would be to fly several dozen armed drones into Reagan International Airport in the heart of Washington, D.C., and destroy a dozen civilian airliners? And what would be the consequences of that? Or anywhere else for that matter. So I think this actually has opened the door. And, it, you know, typically, yeah, we all knew theoretically this was possible. But when you see it demonstrated and demonstrated against a serious military power, everybody sets up and takes notice. So I think this is actually, in that respect, a bigger deal. I also have to think, just in terms of the Russia-Ukraine war, this has to... It has to have an effect on senior people in the Kremlin, other than Putin. Now, maybe they can't do anything about it, but I'm sure they're thinking, you know, what have we gotten ourselves into? And it does. I mean, we don't know how Trump has reacted to it, but you know, it does suggest the Ukrainians have some cards to play, contrary to J.D. Vance and others.
Yeah, I love the memes that are, you know, floating all around the internet now of the, you know, the meeting in the Oval Office, you know, with Zelensky saying, you know, I took out, you know, 15% of Soviet strategic, you know, long range aviation, and you haven't said thank you.
Well, the other one that I saw is Zelensky in a suit, which is just all kinds of different playing cards.
Yeah, so, yeah, I've seen that one too. Look, I don't disagree with what you've said. And, you know, in fact, I mean, one of the things that we did in the National Defense Strategy Commission report was try to, you know, kind of arouse more public discussion and public recognition of the fact that, as you just said a moment ago, if there's another, if we get into a conflict with China, you know, or Russia, you know, the homeland will not be a sanctuary.
Right.
I think a lot of people have focused on the cyber dimension of that. And we talked about that in our report. And, you know, former FBI Director Wray, the last real FBI director, testified to the fact in Congress that the Chinese are sitting all over our critical infrastructure. They can turn off our ATMs, turn off our, you know, electrical grid, water systems, you know, you name it. But there's also a kinetic. I think people don't understand the potential kinetic side of this. And, you know, there some number of years ago, back when you and I were in government, we both saw, you know, intelligence reports about the fact that the Iranians had had a cargo ship out in the Caspian, which they, you know, rolled back the, you know, the, you know, top of one of the holds and up popped a, you know, a missile. You know, you could obviously do the same thing with drones. One of the more recent Chinese military power reports has indicated the Chinese have looked at cargo ships that can be, with containerized weapons on them. For that matter, you know, what would stop somebody, you know, forget about, you know, I have nuclear decapitation on the mind. So, you know, what would stop someone from rolling up a bunch of trucks to the border in Canada and taking out big chunks of, you know, Malmstrom, Minot, or F.E. Warren, where we have a lot of our, you know, nuclear weapons based? Could they reach Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri and take out a lot of B-2s? I don't know. Why not?
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, I'm sure there'll be reactions the same way after the 1967 war, which began with an Israeli strike on Egyptian airfields, and actually Arab airfields around the Middle East. All of a sudden, everybody invested in aircraft shelters, hardened aircraft shelters, and so they weren't able to do that again. So I think, you know, people will be taking defenses more seriously, including things like high-powered microwave and all that.
But actually, I do hope, by the way, that our military takes this seriously. Because I worry a little bit that there's a tendency in our, you know, uniformed services to say, well, you know, that's very clever. Those Ukrainians, they're really very clever, but they're fighting an asymmetric war. We don't have to do that because we're a big, powerful military.
So I hope on one of the chat groups I'm on, a mutual friend of ours, who's a retired, very thoughtful retired colonel, was saying, yeah, you know, we keep on sort of patting the Ukrainians on the head like that. When, you know, what they're doing is they're taking commercial drones and repurposing them and, you know, fiddling with them in interesting ways. And, you know, if some kid in the 82nd Airborne says, I've got an idea, why don't we just buy like, you know, 15 drones, and I've got an idea for how you can rewicker these things and make them useful, you'd get into trouble for going outside channels. I mean, there's, you know, one of the big challenges that any major military now has, but I think particularly ours, is being willing to take stuff that's off the shelf and then tinker with it and then field it. And what, you know, one of the things that the Ukrainians did is they created this, the UAV command is sort of a separate service, and they didn't do it to create it in a separate service in our sense, you know, with its own field of operation. It was to make the connection with the industry much more, much stronger and more direct, and as a way of kind of actually tying it much better to forces in the field. So, speaking of which, I read the Strategic Defense Review that the British just put out, which I think is, I think this conversation is germane to that. So this has been awaited for a long time. It was run by, it was run hands off by the government, which gave it to George Robertson, former distinguished Secretary General of NATO, Richard Barons, who's a former head of the Joint Forces Command for the British, who I actually met with in London, and a friend of ours who's been on the podcast, Fiona Hill. And there are a number of interesting things in it. I have to say, having read it, you know, there's a lot of good. There's, you know, they're clearly focused on Russia. There's very much this, you know, understanding that the homeland could be under attack, that, you know, we're in a different era of war. We have to be ready to fight a prolonged war. There's some interesting stuff about technology. You know, they're very much in favor of the creation of a national armaments director, which they're doing. But the thing that really struck me about it is, of course, like most of these things, there isn't a dollar sign, or in this case, a pound sign attached to this. They're not willing to say, you know, 2.3% of GDP, which is what they're currently spending, is ridiculous. We're going to need to be at least twice that. So there's that. And then the other thing that's missing, and this is apropos of our discussion, is, well, we don't really see that we need to have more soldiers. You know, the British Army is like 73,000 troops, smaller than it was in most of the 19th century. It's, but we can make it 10 times as lethal. And, you know, in the future, only 20% of our force will be crewed in crewed systems, you know, with human beings operating it or inside them, and 40% reusable kinds of things like drones that fly somewhere and do something, and 40% consumable. So I think they are very taken in a way by the vision of warfare that this opens up. But I have to say, I think that's failing to acknowledge what is a lesson of Ukraine that is applicable everywhere, which is in a real war, there are a lot of casualties. You need to replace them. You need to have a system to replace them. And they sort of acknowledge that, but there's nothing that really addresses it. So first, I'm curious what you make of sort of the basic judgments that are there, but also what do you think of the idea of having a strategic review that is done from the outside pretty much in that way, as somebody who has been, you know, the vice chair of our defense commission, which is congressional, not the executive branch. So I'd like to hear you on both the substance, but also on the process.
My fact this week is that Andy Warhol would regularly have his wig cut by a barber and then return the following month wearing a new, longer wig.
Hello, we are No Such Thing as a Fish. We are a British podcast all about facts and trivia and everything interesting in the whole wide world.
We cover everything from pufferfish rectums to the moon to mangrove forest. What else do we do, James?
Oh, well, what about the fact that in 1936, a robot in California shot its inventor in the head?
There you go. If you're intrigued to hear more, peppered with some bad puns and some crude jokes, then check us out. We are No Such Thing as a Fish.
on the process, I think that it was a very good idea to do this. I mean, I spoke actually with Fiona at some length about our own commission and what we had done, and they we provided, you know, copies obviously of our report for, you know, for her and George Robertson and General Barons. And I was not alone, by the way. Another commissioner, Tom Mankin, also briefed Fiona at some length about what we did. And I really, I mean, I've not read it as closely as you have. I've looked at it quickly, and I looked at the, they did a very nice, actually, 2-page summary of their, you know, recommendations and what have you. And the process that they went through seems to be a very similar to what we did, which is, you know, in-depth interviews with all the senior leaders, but also people outside who have views about the world we're operating in and how to do it. I think it's a good idea to get a second opinion. I think most of the previous, you know, British Defense Reviews were done, were too inside, honestly, and therefore not able to address particularly some of the problems they have with acquisition as directly as this one did. I'm on the, you know, strategy comes with a dollar sign, as Bernard Brody famously wrote, and the lack of a pound sign here is, you know, I think more an indication of how difficult a situation a Starmer government finds itself in than anything else. And my worry is that, you know, to the degree, and I think by and large, other people have had, you know, positive view, as you have, of this report. Laurie Friedman had a pretty positive, you know, assessment of this in his blog this morning. My fear is it's not going to get implemented. And my fear is that it won't get implemented for this simple reason. I mean, there were some terrific articles in the Financial Times today going through what the report recommends, how deep a hole the British military is in, et cetera, et cetera. There also was a very interesting piece on public opinion. You know, public opinion by and large supports more spending on defense in Britain. Noticeably, the Labour Party has the lowest amount of support among its electorate for that. The Reform Party, actually, I think, has the highest support, actually. But if you poll Britons on should you raise taxes, you know, overwhelmingly no. Should we cut social spending? Overwhelmingly no. And so the government is in a bit of a bind. You know, this is 2 + 2 + 2, you know, it's got to come out to 6. So how they're going to get around all that, I don't know. I suspect that some of the, you know, we're going to substitute, you know, lethality for mass, you know, of personnel may come from, you know, recognition of that conundrum, that it's, you know, somehow a way out of it. But because obviously, you know, human beings actually cost more than anything else for Western societies in their budget. So I just worry about whether this thing is going to be, you know, implemented or not.
You know, it's the conundrum we all face that, and when I talk to people in London about this, when I was recently there, they acknowledge, you know, the problem is you're going to have to cut some part of the welfare state to pay for this. And I think it's, we actually face the same thing. You know, we have a welfare state, we have a rather inefficient welfare state. Although, you know, at this point I stand up for Medicare, which is actually pretty efficient. Social Security in some ways is too, but, you know.
It's very parsimonious, actually, compared to European welfare states.
But you know, we spend a lot of money on it, and you would either have to raise taxes to do the things we need to do, or cut the welfare state. We're not willing to do either. You know, this is part of a sort of a deeper disease of the West, I think. By the way, this is just parenthetically, since you mentioned reform, Would you want to place a small wager on whether Nigel Farage at some point gets to be Prime Minister of Great Britain?
I'm not taking that action.
Yeah. I mean, I follow British politics in part because it's fun. And increasingly, I'm coming to the conclusion at some point, he's going to end up as the Prime Minister. And God only knows what that'll be like. But I don't think it'll be Trumpian. It'll be a little bit wild and woolly. But
he's big on defense, though.
What?
He's big on defense. Unlike some of these other right-wing parties in Europe.
I think, in a way, this gets to the larger issue, which is, the Trump phenomenon is distinctly American, as you and I have often discussed. It's got deep roots in all kinds of issues in our country. But I think a lot of European countries and other countries around the world have somewhat similar issues, with somewhat different roots, but they're there as well. And the British, I think, will have their Trumpian moment, except it'll be a Farageian moment. And it'll be over the same sorts of things, a lot of it driven by social attitudes and cultural issues. A lot of it driven by immigration, which is a huge issue for them. It'll take us to a different world.
I don't disagree. I mean, the Polish presidential election is sort of, one potential indicator. I mean, the counter indicator, of course, was the Romanian election, although that had all sorts of, special characteristics to it because the Supreme Court stepped in and outlawed one candidate, as the French have with, Marine Le Pen. We'll see, whether she actually gets to run and whether that helps or hurts the far right in France. I mean, they could come to power too, very easily. One could easily imagine that. I think actually there's more, I don't want to say uniformity. I mean, all of this is expressed in particular political cultural terms in each country, which are unique. But there are some common phenomena, as you say, one of which is migration. That has been a huge, part of it everywhere. Another part of it has been the unequal distribution of gains from globalization, which have disproportionately affected working class, not just Americans, but working class people around the world. The collapse of social democratic parties. I mean, that is true throughout Europe, but our Democratic Party is not a social democratic party, but I think you look at the polling and you could say that's a party pretty much in collapse. And then one other element, which is, I think, and this is a global phenomenon, the increased presence of women in the workforce, which I think has been very, sort of psychologically dislocating for a lot of men and particularly younger men who now face competition in the workforce from women. I mean, in our case, it's also competition from the workforce from women who are more highly educated because more young men are dropping out and not completing a college education. So I think, there's a lot that's more common to all this than sometimes I think we, give credence to.
I think there'll be one other issue, by the way, which is AI. I begin reading more and more about that, and, I'm beginning to think that, over the next couple of years, you're really going to see this tidal wave of job destruction from AI. Now, we all understand the arguments. Okay, the buggy whip manufacturers go away, but there are jobs on the assembly line for Model T Fords. But I think this one is different. One thing that strikes me is that the destruction by AI of entry level jobs is really going to do a further level of damage. And I have to think it's going to have political repercussions. If kids can't get a start doing things. Already, you know, you're beginning to see unemployment rates go up for recent college graduates and that kind of thing. You know, we're in for a wild ride here. I mean, there'll be wonderful things that come out of AI, you know, all kinds of diseases that'll be cured. And there already are all kinds of conveniences. I mean, I don't know about you, but my map reading skills have deteriorated because I just let the car tell me where I'm supposed to go. But there'll be, you know, there's also, it's, you know, at some point there're going to be a lot of people who drive cars and make, you know, supplement their earnings or maybe make their living out of driving cars, and they're going to be out of work.
No, I agree. I think, I think there's going to be a lot of repercussions from this. I agree. I tend to not allow myself to be too panicked by the kind of more apocalyptic vision or versions of this, because we've had this before. I mean, computers were going to put everybody out of work. You know, their automation in the 60s was going to put everybody out of work, you know, machine tools. So I think, you know, there's going to be a lot here. Obviously, this can be very, you know, discomforting. But I mean, I still think, you know, just take a look at that. We were talking earlier about the HHS report that, you know, somebody tried to write, you know, with AI. There's still a lot of problems here where you really need a human.
This is the one that was making up articles.
Yeah, making up sources.
It was very typical, I have to say, of the Trump administration that they, you know, they put this out on a government website. Never occurred to them to have anybody check any of it.
Yeah, I know. Ridiculous. We need to get on to one other topic, which has been a major source of speculation this week, which is the situation in the Middle East, which has a lot of different elements to it. One is what's going on in Gaza, what the Israelis are doing. Some of it's got to do with what's going on in Syria, what the Turks and what we are doing in Syria. Yep. And then, of course, a lot has to do with what Steve Witkoff, the president's Swiss Army knife negotiator, you know, for all things, is doing with Iran in what looks to be kind of JCPOA, you know, Iran arms, nuclear arms deal 2.0. As far as I can tell. So what do you make of all this?
Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop, because members get cash back at over 3,500 stores across every category, including fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, and more. Your favorite stores like Lenovo and Wine.com pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members, and that could be you. Cashback is deposited directly into your PayPal account, or if you prefer, Rakuten can send you a check. The choice is yours. You can even maximize your savings by stacking cashback on top of other deals, like store sales and coupons. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while you're doing it? Membership is free, and it's easy to sign up. Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million members who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's Rakuten. Your cashback really adds up.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. June is Men's Mental Health Month, and every year, 6 million men suffer from depression. If you're feeling overwhelmed, the strongest thing you can do is ask for help. And BetterHelp makes it easy. Take a short online quiz and connect from home with a qualified therapist. Visit BetterHelp.com to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of different pieces to it. By the way, that last one, you shared an article with me, which Jake Sullivan was saying, well, you know, on this one, I really agree with the Trump administration, which I must say is kind of confirming my view of Jake Sullivan's views of foreign policy and his astuteness as a statesman. So I think I'll try to take some of the different pieces of it. On Israel and Gaza, obviously, this is tragic. There's an interesting piece, I think, in Foreign Affairs by Asaf Orion, who's a retired Israeli, is he a colonel or one star?
No, he was a brigadier.
He was a brigadier, which is quite critical of the Netanyahu government, and I think correctly so. It's not clear to me that they're actually going to be able to achieve anything. You know, you're talking now about 20 surviving hostages plus a bunch of bodies. I find it hard to believe that you can actually destroy Hamas as an entity in the way that they're trying to do it, which is by, you know, clearing, moving people out of the way and then destroying everything. And I don't think they particularly have a plan for, I'm sure they have some plans, but I don't think, it's not clear to me they've got a real plan for, you know, what do you do with the population of Gaza after this? On the other hand, what I do think is, so the basic idea that they had for the delivery of humanitarian aid, I think is right, which is that you cannot trust UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which was totally corrupted and taken over by Hamas, that Hamas has basically been able to use food supply as a way of controlling the population. And that also Hamas actually had stores of food that it just uses for its own people, its own fighters and so forth. So there's that. And the idea is that, you know, you create a separate American-led relief foundation, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, I think, with American security guards on. How is it actually being implemented on the ground? I have to say, I can't tell. I mean, there are chaotic scenes, but I would expect chaotic scenes. I mean, in most, you know, humanitarian disaster areas are chaotic. I think all along the Israelis have simply not put the effort that I would have wished they would have put into the governance, you know, the kind of post-fighting management and administration of the area. One of the problems that I think that has obstructed that, whereas Americans can imagine counterinsurgency, you know, in the way that we used to talk about during Iraq and Afghanistan, where you separate the population from the insurgents, if necessary, move them around. But then, you know, you kind of get the passive or the active support of the population in, you know, keeping the insurgents away. I think the Israelis think, and in that this respect, they're probably right, that you're never going to be able to, they can never win that population over. And so they, you know, in a certain way, classic counterinsurgency can never work for them. Now, that's partly because of choices that they've made along the way. So it's not as though this was simply a given. But that is, I think, the fix in which they find themselves. What's your take?
No, I agree with that. I mean, again, implementation is key here. I agree that you needed some other form of distribution than what you had before, which was totally corrupted. Ideally, what you would have had would have been some kind of international group, hopefully with some of the Arab states, maybe the Gulf Arab states, participating and funding the humanitarian relief administered by PMFs, private military companies, PMCs. But the problem is they're trying to do that at the same time that they're trying to conduct military operations.
Yeah.
And military operations, as both you and as Asaf Orion in the Foreign Affairs article you mentioned, both suggest to what end? I mean, what exactly is the political objective here, other than, you know, saving Bibi's bacon at home? Yeah. Asaf, by the way, I know him a little bit. He's a very smart guy.
He's extremely smart.
A very smart, very capable officer. So, I think it's hard to see how anything, you know, good is going to come of this. I do think it links to, you know, some of the other, you know, things we're talking about, including Syria, where, you know, I understand sort of the Israeli concern about you know, Syria becoming an ungoverned space with a lot of jihadists running around. But on the other hand, and here I'm going to, you know, say that I think the Trump administration at least seems to be trying to do perhaps the right thing, although typically I'm afraid it's going to do the right thing in the wrong way, which is to say to try and give this Syrian government a running chance at, you know, standing up and stabilizing the country and letting it become something, you know, different than what it was under Assad, you know, for 50 years, where it was just a constant thorn in our side, thorn in Israel's side, source of you know, broader disruption, a cat's paw for the Iranians in the region. So I think it's good that they've got a special envoy. I'm not sure it's great that the special envoy is Tom Barrack, the ambassador to Turkey, because I think that may give too much weight to Turkish considerations here. And the Turks have a big interest in all this because they are a neighbor of Syria's. They've been a major sponsor of the HTS, the force that's taken the country over. But I worry that some of what the Israelis have done, which is, you know, at one level understandable, is strikes on military bases and depots to try and make sure that these weapons don't get turned and used on Israel. That's all understandable. But I worry that some of what they're doing might bring about the very thing they're worried about, which is a, you know, unstable, you know, jihadi overrun Syria.
It's a devilish problem, and I think it would be for any highly capable American or Israeli government, and we don't really have either of those. I mean, for example, there was just a news item about, us clearing the way for the Syrians to bring several thousand foreign fighters into what's sort of the nascent Syrian army. Look, this is one of the issues that people have not been talking about for a while because nobody wants to talk about Iraq and the Middle East. But, you know, you have this floating army of thousands and thousands of jihadists who will go wherever there's a jihad. And, you know, this is actually quite now at this point, quite an old phenomenon. I mean, I remember before 9/11, when I was on this advisory panel at CIA, they showed us this video, which they had just been picked up in Jordan. It was a video about all kinds of foreign fighters who belonged to this thing called Al-Qaeda, which I had never really heard of or I hadn't really paid much attention to. But now you have that. And, you know, those people go look, you know, started in some ways, I think, with the Afghanistan jihad. But these people will go from place to place, and they're not going to become, kind of normal law-abiding citizens who just want to do their bit and then return to civilian life. So I think it's a devilish problem. There's also another issue, which, you know, given your history as an ambassador to Turkey, I think it's particularly interesting. I'd like to hear your view. I mean, I am struck by the role that Turkey is playing. Now, on the one hand, you know, it does seem to me to be sort of neo-Ottoman, you know, with the Turks are playing this important role, and they play an important role in Ukraine, and on the whole, I think a beneficial one. They are present in Libya, as the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, very much was. I mean, that's where Kemal Atatürk really, cut his teeth as somebody who could lead insurgents. They are a presence in the Persian Gulf as well. And I guess the questions I have for you is, you know, first, if our friend Henri Barki, who's been writing about this, is right, and, you know, Erdogan's days are numbered, does this project end with Erdogan? And my instinct is to say, I bet you it doesn't, although I mean, it'd be good to see him out of the picture. But I have a feeling that this is sort of what you can expect from a prosperous, self-confident Turkey, although they've been having a lot of economic troubles recently.
My fact this week is that Andy Warhol would regularly have his wig cut by a barber and then return the following month wearing a new, longer wig.
Hello, we are No Such Thing as a Fish. We are a British podcast all about facts and trivia and everything interesting in the whole wide world.
We cover everything from pufferfish rectums to the moon to mangrove forest. What else do we do, James?
Oh, well, what about the fact that in 1936, a robot in California shot its inventor in the head?
There you go. If you're intrigued to hear more, peppered with some bad puns and some crude jokes, then check us out. We are No Such Thing as a Fish.
But the other thing is, you know, should we welcome this? Should we have no alternative, I think, except but to deal with it. But how should we judge it?
There are a couple of different questions in there. So on the question of Erdogan's political longevity, you know, I hope Henri is right. Certainly, he points to a lot of, you know, ongoing problems that Turkey has, so domestically, including the fact that, you know, even while Turkey's playing this very large role that you just described regionally, they're busy arresting more mayors and more mayors of districts in Istanbul, which sort of tells you that he's, you know, uneasy, you know, lies the head that wears the crown. He's clearly nervous about the domestic political situation. I read Henri's article with interest, and certainly I think it would be salutary for Turkey if Erdogan were to leave the scene.
You're not convinced?
I'm not convinced, and so far nobody's made money betting against this guy, you know, in domestic Turkish politics. On the broader question, I do think Turkey's ambitions outstrip its means. And I think that sort of neo-Ottomanism and a large Turkish role in the Arab Middle East rings very differently in Arab ears than it does in Turkish ears. And I think one needs to pay some attention to that as well. We need a capable, able partner in Turkey, which has the largest, military in NATO. And in terms of European security, I know Europeans are looking towards the Turks now as an important part of the European security future. But I think that I worry that that's going to, you know, incline people to look the other way while Erdogan continues with this authoritarian project. On the other hand, if you look at it from his point of view, which is kind of the one you sketched out, they are primus inter pares at a minimum in Syria. They've composed a lot of their differences with Iraq over the years. The PKK has voted to dissolve itself, which means that you are potentially sitting on the cusp of the end of a very mean and ugly insurgency that killed over 40,000 Turks and Kurds in Turkey since the early 1980s. He's ensconced in Somalia and Qatar, as you said, and in Eritrea and, Libya. Turkey, though, remains very divided about this. I mean, you know, Atatürk, famously had a slogan which was happy as he who is a Turk. And basically he wanted to get Turkey out of the whole business of being a Middle East superpower. Erdogan's trying to get them back in. I think Turks are divided over this. His policy in Syria was very unpopular until the Assad regime fell, which opened up the way for him to get these 4 million refugees who've been a charge on the Turkish Commonweal, you know, for the last decade, kind of pushed across the border and back into Syria. So, you know, does it survive him? I suspect elements of it will. And the appetite of Turks for a broader foreign policy, a bigger foreign policy, footprint in the region than we were used to in the Kemalist years. I think that's real, but I think it without Erdogan, it might be a little bit more tempered and a little bit less likely to look for opportunities to be in opposition to us.
So we're just about out of time, but could you just say a few words about, you know, what this very peculiar negotiation with the Iranians, where you know, over the weekend, they're saying, yeah, we're essentially going to give them a sort of JCPOA kind of deal where they can have low levels of enrichment, which, you know, is to my mind giving away the store. And then Trump goes, no, that's not true. I mean, if part of this is the internal disarray of the administration. And I think, by the way, I would interpret the Trump tweets as another taco that that he began getting public criticism for looking weak, which he hates. And so he therefore chickened out, which is, you know, a little bit paradoxical, I suppose.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, it's very hard to read the tea leaves right now. I mean, the Iranians are saying they're going to reject this deal, which appears to, you know, contain some steps that would allow them to continue to be able to enrich or to have the right to enrich. I mean, honestly, the Saudis have been telling the Iranians, take this deal. I think the Saudi advice is actually very good. If I were the Iranians, I would take this deal in a heartbeat. You know, I don't know whether Iranian politics will allow them to do that. The deal, I think, I think Jake Sullivan's reaction to it's very revealing. I think, Jake basically said at Harvard, I think it was at Harvard where he was speaking, that, you know, I'm looking forward to how the administration explains to, you know, Senator Cotton and Senator Cruz how this is different from, you know, what we did in the JCPOA in the Obama administration. Look, I think, you know, again, we don't know exactly what's within in the deal, but what it sounds like is something that allows the Iranians to maintain an ability to enrich, which is going to be very problematic from the point of view of the Israelis. Now, if the president decides that he's got the greatest deal of all time and he's going to tout it as such, as he did with North Korea in the first term, and that he's going to, you know, go to Tehran and that they're going to build a Trump Tower in Tehran and he's going to make, you know, make Iran's, you know, Iranians, you know, great again. I don't know. We'll see how, you know, McConnell and Cotton and Cruz react in the Senate. I think there'll be some Democrats who will support this. I mean, I think Jake is just one indication of that, but I think you'll get support from, you know, Jeff Merkley and Chris Murphy and other Democrats. there'll be some Democratic opposition as well, I suspect, from, you know, Schumer and Booker and maybe a few others. but I think where it will really leave Bibi in a very tough place, right?
Yeah, he is in a tough place. I mean, I think, you know, it just didn't dawn on the Israelis that if Trump betrayed everybody else around him, he's perfectly willing to betray you guys too.
Well, yeah.
Well, I think we're probably at the end. I think the cheery thing is that after discussing the contemporary world, the good news is that next week we'll be able to dive back into the past. So I just want to say I always look forward to talking with you, but I particularly look forward to what we're going to be able to do next week.
Well, I'm somewhat intimidated because I'll be talking to two of the leading experts on the American Revolution, which is not a period that I'm at all expert in, although I have read a little bit about it, including works by you. So, you know, we'll leave that till next week, but it should be a fun discussion. I'm looking forward to it.
My fact this week is that Andy Warhol would regularly have his wig cut by a barber and then return the following month wearing a new, longer wig.
Hello, we are No Such Thing as a Fish. We are a British podcast all about facts and trivia and everything interesting in the whole wide world.
We cover everything from pufferfish rectums to the moon to mangrove forest. What else do we do, James?
Oh, well, what about the fact that in 1936, a robot in California shot its inventor in the head?
There you go. If you're intrigued to hear more, peppered with some bad puns and some crude jokes, then check us out. We are No Such Thing as a Fish.